fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle, we are right smack dab in the middle of it, right on schedule.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. Charlotte's off tonight. The first clip is 19 minutes and 40 seconds of this second hour. And it's an update of Stephen Kinzer's book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, that we recently had an interview with. And the second 39 minutes and 21 seconds would be our original broadcast at Charlotte. Littlefield and I did with him back in October 2010. Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got one of the finest guests. I think I would rank him at the top of any of our guests over the last 8 years. His name is Stephen Kinzer, and he's written a fine series of books, and the latest one was just recently last fall was The Brothers, about the Dulles brothers. But also we're going to talk a little bit about and speak a little bit about a book he wrote 4 years ago, and it's about Turkey and Iran being the new powers in the Middle East. Welcome to our program, Stephen Kinzer.
Always good to be with you.
Well, I tell you what, we were talking before that we started the program this evening that this book was written 4 years ago, and actually that's what sort of kindled my interest. Was over 4 years ago we interviewed you on this book about Iran and Turkey called, and it was so prophetic, and now you're saying you're getting a lot of feedback now and interest in a book you wrote 4 years ago, which maybe at the time was controversial. Tell us about that. First, tell us a little bit about yourself first, Dr. Kinzer, and then we'll go from there, okay?
Sure. Well, great to be on your show, and I love the audience you appeal to. So I was a New York Times reporter for more than 20 years. I spent most of that as a foreign correspondent. Of course, when you're a newspaper reporter, you're always focusing on what's happening right now. Now that I've left the New York Times and kind of risen up from journalism or fallen down, I'm trying to put together everything that I saw and ask myself, how did it fit together? Or what did it all mean? What are the larger lessons I can draw from experiences I had in reporting from about 50 different countries? So one of the concepts that I came up with, particularly after my years of covering Iran and Turkey, is that if you looked around the geopolitics of the Middle East, the United States was stuck in some very odd relationships that may have made sense decades ago, but no longer do. In particular, we have decided that Saudi Arabia is one of our closest allies, when in fact, if you look at what strategic interests are out there, the strategic interests of Saudi Arabia are opposed to the long-term strategic interests of the United States. What's good for Saudi Arabia in the long run is not good for us. And what we want is not good for them. So that does not make them good partners. Iran, however, is a different situation. Here is a country that we have treated as a hostile enemy for a third of a century. But when you get past the emotion, you realize that many of Iran's long-term strategic goals coincide with ours. That being a big Shia country, the number one obsession, the terror, the fear in Iran is of Sunni extremism, of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda variety. We also claim to be terrified of that kind of extremism. So why don't we cooperate with the one government in that part of the world that is even more threatened by Al-Qaeda and that ideology than we are? The reason we don't is we're still caught in the anger and emotions of things that have happened in the past. Emotion is always the enemy of wise statesmanship. And I hope that with what's happening now, maybe we'll be able to see that in the long run, actually, we need to be thinking about a different set of alliances in the Middle East than the ones we've embraced over past years.
Right. You published this book, and what we're speaking about this evening is Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Well, both Iran and Turkey are becoming major players in the Middle East. And so it was very prophetic when you wrote this book. And now you're saying, are you getting more calls from reporters and journalists about this book today?
Absolutely, not only from America, but in England, where there was a British edition of this book published. I think that it's difficult for the public in particular to get over certain stereotypes. Now, one of our stereotypes is that Iran is a country ruled by wild-eyed fanatics, whereas countries like Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf countries are calm and much like us. In fact, having traveled in both regions, I can say the opposite is true. One thing you want to look at when you're choosing partners and allies in this world is long-term strategic goals. We already talked about that. But there's another standard that I think is important. You want to choose partners and allies that have societies that are somewhat like your own. Saudi Arabian society, where women are not allowed to vote or drive, and religious extremism is the central part of political ideology, doesn't look anything like the United States. The way they live and think and approach the world is not parallel to ours. Iran is very different. Iran is a surprisingly vibrant society, and having been there now several times in recent years, I think I can say Iran probably has the most pro-American population of any country in the world. I've never been in a place where when you tell people you're American, they surround you on the street and tell you how happy they are to see you. One woman on a street corner in Shiraz said to me, we know they say terrible things about us over there, but we love America so much. You don't even hear that in Canada. So the Iranian sympathy with the United States is a great strategic asset for us. We don't have very many populations in the Middle East that are sympathetic to us. We ought to try to get rid of our old stereotypes and realize that accepting new realities is actually something that will promote our long-term strategic interests, which is something that at this moment is especially important.
Right. The Iranian demographics, they have quite a young population. Is that conducive to understanding of Western views and internet and things like this? Is that one of the reasons
why? You're absolutely right. I think there were two big reasons for this. First of all, it's true. There's a very young population in Iran. Most of them don't remember the Shah. They don't remember the hostage crisis. They're the Twitter generation. They're very modern and open to the world. But I think there might also be another factor, and that is, you know, it's an odd situation. Here in the United States, we have a secular government, but the population is quite religious. In Iran, it's the other way around. Decades of living under religious rule have turned Iranians into real secularists. They don't want to see theocracy anymore, and that's something that separates them from most people in the Middle East. In most countries, they've never had religious power. So since all other forms of power have failed, there's a certain attractiveness to the rhetoric of Islamic extremism. But in Iran, they have experience with 35 years of religious government by an Islamic regime. They don't want that anymore. They've had it. They understand what it means. They're through with it. They don't want to see other countries in the Middle East have to go through that. So the Iranians have had an experience with religious rule that many other countries in that part of the world haven't had yet. They're already fed up with it, and they want to try to stop this tide. So in an actual sense, they are our best potential allies in that part of the world, and they understand the region far better than we do because they live there.
Right. Have you ever seen Saudi Arabia do such overt acts as in the last few years in supporting some of these jihadists and stuff? I've never seen them that overt in there and arming and supporting some of these groups. It was a big surprise to me. What would be your comments?
It's truly remarkable that over so many years now, going back to before our invasion of Afghanistan and before 9/11, our so-called friends in Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf countries have been the principal financiers of radical Sunni terrorism of the Al-Qaeda variety. Yet, we continue to be their friends. We continue to hold them very close as our dear allies, whether that has to do with tradition or with oil or with geopolitics. It doesn't make sense for us over the long run. We are financing our own assassins. It's this Persian Gulf billions that come in from oil that is financing this global wave of extremism that we're now seeing reach such a peak in Syria and Iraq. Finally, maybe, now that it has become so acute, we're forcing ourselves to face the fact that our so-called friends are really not friends, and maybe our so-called enemies would be better partners.
Right. What a good point there, Stephen. About the activities and the current events in Iraq, where do you see, what would be your comments on projecting that and extrapolating what would happen and what will happen? And have we acted quickly enough to help the existing Iraqi government? It looks like we want to unseat the government. That's the wrong time to do that. What do you think?
The real problem in Iraq goes back to our intervention back in 2003. When you crash violently into the politics of another country, you're doing something like releasing a wheel at the top of a hill. You can let it go, but you have no control over how it bounces or where it ultimately ends up. This was an almost inevitable result of our invasion of Iraq. It had to come to this because we decided that we wanted to impose a system from abroad on Iraqis. All the political system they've had in the last 10 years is not what they chose. It's what we imposed on them. So now you're starting to hear this new narrative, which is that we were just about to win. We could have been strong, but instead President Obama decided to pull out his troops at the crucial moment and we lost the war. This is not correct. We've spent about $13 trillion over there, $13 billion, in Iraq. Now, some people are trying to tell us, oh, if we only spend 14 or maybe 15, we're going to win the war. So we've lost thousands of soldiers there. Maybe if we could just lose a few more hundred, we could win the war. This is not a wise long-term strategy. We have to realize that our project there has been a failure. We need to try to resist this temptation to believe that more American military power can really solve the situation in the Middle East. It's difficult for me to believe that there are still people out there who think sending more guns and bringing more American generals into planning in the Middle East is going to stabilize the situation. We should have learned that lesson a long time ago. You know, some terrible things are happening in that part of the world. It's very distressing. Nonetheless, don't forget that Europe was kept in the Dark Ages by religion for 1,000 years. These are processes that countries have to go through. And as long as we can guarantee our number one security interest, which is to make sure that none of those countries or movements become a base for attacks on the United States, we really don't have any more vital interest there.
Right. As far as Europe goes, is there beginning to be a separation between Europe and the United States? And should we expect Europe to take more of a stepped up responsibility for the Ukraine? What are your thoughts there?
I think certainly in the Middle East, you're seeing a little bit of a different approach. The Europeans are very interested in reopening relationships with Iran. They're not so caught up in the anti-Iran emotion as we are, and they see Iran as a good partner. When it comes to Ukraine, I think the European approach is probably is wiser than the American approach. I think what many Europeans are thinking to themselves is that they have to live very close to each other. You know, Europe is a very tightly packed-in neighborhood. It's so different from the United States. If you're sitting in Denver or Atlanta, you can drive all day and most of the night before you reach a foreign border. If you're sitting in Munich, you've got five foreign borders within 150 miles. In Europe, you have a consciousness that people you don't want to confront each other. You don't want to poison the close relationship because your neighbors are right on top of you. You're not separated, as we are in America, by vast oceans from any country that can do you any trouble. So their idea is don't be violent, don't punish, don't sanction, don't confront. Try to reduce tensions. So I think in the United States, there's this outburst of outrage. And when you see something like what happened in Ukraine, and we want to go in and crush the evildoer. I think in Europe, there's a consciousness that this is a long-term process, and that sometimes the punishment for bad behavior by a country can actually be more destabilizing than the bad behavior itself. So Europe is taking a much longer-term view of this, and I think Americans, maybe because we're such a young country, are a little more impatient. We want to solve things right away. Europe is ready to calm down, wait, and look at the long term.
Right. Getting back to Iran, when Iran is going to go into Iraq to help, and how would that work out? How is that going to work out?
Well, don't forget, of course, that Iran is the heartland of Shia Islam.
Right.
The only other country in the world that has a majority Shia population is Iraq, and some of the major Shia shrines are in Iraq. The Sunni extremism that we saw in the jihads in Afghanistan is really on the edge of explosion in Iraq. So the Iraqis are looking around for whoever can help them, and the Iranians are terrified. You know, Iran does not consider the United States to be a real existential threat. They don't consider Israel to be a real existential threat. All the major geopolitical strategists in Iran see the major existential threat to Iran as radical al-Qaeda-type ideology. Don't forget that those al-Qaeda militants hate Shiites. They want to kill all Shiites. They hate them worse than they hate Christians and Jews. They consider them evil apostates. They want to go into those holy sites in places like Najaf and Karbala in Iraq and level them to the ground. This is something that's terrifying for the Iranians. So the al-Qaeda fanatics hate Iranians more than they hate Americans. The Iranians are really in their crosshairs. This puts them in a position like us. They are even more terrified of al-Qaeda than we are. They're right in the neighborhood, and they want to do whatever they can to help stop this advance. That's also in the interest of the United States. If we can put aside our emotions, we can realize this is a country that has not only a military power, but has a religious basis for popularity in Iraq. So some kind of coordination between the U.S. and Iran not only could be very helpful in turning the militant tide in Iraq, but it could be the basis for a longer-term partnership in which the United States realigns its relationships in the Middle East and starts becoming friendly with countries that really support us and not be friends anymore with countries that are funding those who want to kill us.
Right. Do you think a three-state division in Iraq with maybe a district of Baghdad and then a proportionate distribution of the oil revenue to those three states, depending on population, might be a solution in Iraq? Would that be any solution?
I think what we're going to see is something like that emerging de facto. We might not even have to have a redrawing of a map and a conference and a treaty signed. But what I think you're going to see as a result of this Iraq explosion is not a complete victory of the militants, but they will maintain themselves in power in certain parts of Iraq. So although there may not be an official division of Iraq, I think you're going to see something like that emerging, which is another example of the foolishness of the original map-making in that part of the world, which really is part of the long-term problem that created the situation we're now in.
Right. In other words, those oil companies in there, they drew lines, and it wasn't in respect of tribal areas or anything else, so they actually created a division in the area that was artificial.
Absolutely. Those countries in the Middle East are mainly fake countries. They're just made up by somebody sitting in a men's club in London drawing lines on a map after World War I. The one country in that region that is the opposite of a fake country, that's a real country, is Iran. There's no such thing as an Iraqi tradition or a Jordanian heritage. These are modern concepts. But Iran has existed for thousands of years with more or less the same language and more or less the same boundaries. And it is a country with a very deep sense of itself. So this is a country that really in many ways culturally, but particularly politically and strategically, makes a good partner for the United States. And if we can get over some of the overhang of past misdeeds, and both of these countries, U.S. and Iran, have done terrible things to each other, we can move into a future that will allow us to face together a serious threat to us both.
Right. I certainly do appreciate you being with us this evening, Stephen Kinzer. And that would be StephenKinzer.com is your website, StephenKinzer.com. And, boy, I tell you what, that book Reset, you were so prophetic with that, and we certainly congratulate you on being so far ahead and so farsighted in your view of the Middle East. And that's going to add to a solution, I know for sure.
Wonderful to be with you again. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. Good night.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with...
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Yeah, how you doing, Charlotte? How's it going up there? Okay, everything all right?
Yeah, the weather's been doing us doing very well up here. Thank you.
Oh, it's over 100 degrees down in here. This first hour, we have really a fine guest. Stephen Kinzer is his name. He's an award-winning foreign correspondent. He's covered more than 50 countries on 5 continents. His articles and books have led the Washington Post to place him among the best in popular foreign policy storytelling. Welcome to our program, Stephen Kinzer.
It's wonderful to be with you. I'm glad, however, it's not as hot here as it is where you are.
Oh, I tell you, it is bad down here in Texas, I tell you. Your recent book, your latest book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. How did you first conceive of this book? What were your beginning thoughts? Tell our listening audience.
I was the New York Times first bureau chief in Istanbul, in Turkey. And that was a thrilling experience. Turkey is a dazzling place and very, very interesting to discover for those of us from the outside who don't really know it well. During the time, the years that I was posted in Turkey working for the New York Times, I was also sent to Iran, which is also one of the most fascinating countries in that part of the world. And I really came during my years there and my travels around the whole region to realize that Turkey and Iran are very special countries in that part of the world. They are, first of all, the only two major non-Arab countries in the Muslim Middle East. The Persians are not Arabs, the Iranians, and the Turks are also not Arabs. So that's one of the very interesting aspects of them. They both have very long and very deep cultures, especially Iran. Iran, Persia, was the first empire in world history, and it's got 25 centuries of very rich history, including not just imperial expansion, but science and poetry and law. So these two countries really came to fascinate me. They've also been the only two countries in the Muslim Middle East that have had 100 years now with constitutions and learning about what democracy is and developing democratic ideas. So although Turkish society has managed to produce a democratic government and Iran democratic society has not, for reasons we can get into later, still, these are two peoples that have a long history of democracy. They've decided on their own that democracy is the system that they want. It wasn't imposed on them at the point of a gun by a foreign army. And they've had 100 years to work on the ideas of democracy, which is so important because democracy is not just an election. Democracy is a whole way of dealing with life's problems. So Turkey and Iran began increasingly to fascinate me, and I began to think that these countries, over the long term, 21st century, would actually be very intriguing partners for the United States. That that's the idea that I develop in this book. I talk about then what are our old relationships in the Middle East, and I talk about how Turkey and Iran developed so differently from the countries around them, and then I extract from this history some lessons for the future.
Right. Boy, I think you're right. You're spot on this. In fact, you've written an article about BP, and they go way back in Iran, don't they, British Petroleum?
This is really a remarkable turn of events for me to be sitting here like every other American and reading the stories of the BP blowout in the Gulf and just watching helplessly like everyone else as that company seems to be shown to have cared so little for the physical environment and for the human environment around it. But actually, this is nothing new for me, because I discovered this about BP a long time ago when I first began to focus on Iran. You know, when I first went to Iran, I asked myself a question that I always ask myself when I'm going to a new country, and that is, how did this country get this way? Why is this country rich and powerful, or why is this country poor and miserable? And with Iran, I asked myself this. So Iran has such a rich history. It's really one of the greatest civilizations on earth. But yet, look how low they've fallen. They've got this reactionary religious regime, and people are not free. What happened? Why? And as I began to look into the history, I saw that actually Iran was a thriving democracy in the period after World War II. And as a result of having a government that responded to what people wanted, that government focused on one huge project. That was the nationalization of Iranian oil. Since the beginning of the 20th century, when Iran was first discovered to be sitting on top of an ocean of oil, the British had declared themselves owners of all the oil in Iran. And they had one company owned mainly by the British government that had the exclusive right to extract and refine and sell and export Iranian oil, while the Iranians, who were sitting on the resource, got almost nothing from it. So when there was a democracy in Iran in the early 1950s, the Iranian government nationalized that oil industry. That nationalization set off explosions in London and also in Washington. The CIA sent one of its top agents to Iran to overthrow that government, and that resulted not only in the overthrow of one leader, but the end of democracy in Iran up to the present day. Now, what was the oil company that caused all this, that was the center of the destruction of democracy in Iran, that produced the oppressive regime that is in power there now? That company, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, soon after the coup in Iran in 1953, changed its name to British Petroleum, and it later changed its name to BP. So when you're telling me that the Gulf catastrophe has shown this company to be insensitive to the needs of people in the communities where it's operating, I can tell you, I knew that long ago once I discovered what this company did in Iran 50 years ago.
Well, you wrote an excellent book. What was it entitled? All the Shah's Men, is that right?
Exactly. Very good.
You set out the coup that happened there. And the CIA's part in it, and they undermined a duly elected democratic government, did they not?
It was one of those cases in the world when the United States overthrew a leader who embodied what we like to call American values and replaced him with a tyrant who despised everything the United States stands for. We did this for very short-term reasons, which is that a person who upholds what we call American values of patriotism and democracy is not going to do everything the U.S. tells him to do. But a tyrant is willing to do that. Actually, we then placed more importance, when we're figuring out who we would like to lead a country, on finding someone who would do everything we wanted than on finding someone who responded to the needs of his own people. We wanted leaders who did not respond to the needs of their own people, but who responded to the needs of the United States.
Right. That was so interesting over there, and of course tragic when they brought the Shah back in and placed him back into power. Now this book today, You're saying that Turkey, we need to regain or reevaluate our relationship and reset it. Is that correct?
Yes. Turkey gives us a unique opportunity in the Middle East because Turkey is a Muslim country that's ruled by believing Muslims who have respect throughout the Middle East as highest believers. And, of course, they have the cultural history of the Ottoman Empire.
Okay, Stephen, we've got to cut away to a break. We'll be right back. Thanks. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield, and I'd like to give our special guest his website. I'd like to put that out to the listening audience. It's StephenKinzer.com. That's StephenKinzer. Kinzer, KINZER.com. Go check out all the books, articles, papers, presentations, pictures. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you.
Stephen, I noticed a very poignant thing in your book. You dedicated this to your grandparents. Is that true?
My mother was a refugee from Holland, and her parents are fascinating sounding figures that I never had a chance to meet. My mother's father was an anti-Nazi newspaper columnist in Holland in the period before the Germans invaded Holland. After the Nazi invasion, he was taken prisoner with his wife, and they died in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. In a way, although I never met them, of course, their fate forms kind of a part of my identity, and it has led me to ask what we could do to be sure that something like this would not happen again. When I look toward the Middle East, I see the place where these tensions are the highest, and in a way, I think maybe that background is part of what has led me to look for an alternative approach. Well, we have seen that the Middle East today is a den of violence and hatred and all sorts of social degradation. New threats are arising to us, but also tantalizing new opportunities out there in the Middle East as the geopolitical landscape has shifted so dramatically since the end of the Cold War. But we're not able to take advantage of them because our policy toward the Middle East is stuck in the 20th century. That's the policy we shaped to deal with the Cold War. But the Cold War has been over for 20 years, and the strategic environment in the Middle East has changed dramatically in that time. So one thing we can see when we look at what the Middle East is today is that whatever we've been doing up to now to pacify and calm the Middle East has not been working. You know, Einstein had that great definition of insanity. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. That's essentially what we're doing in the Middle East. And so as the crisis there intensifies, and this is not a crisis that's frozen and just sort of looking for an academic solution. It's one that's getting worse and worse every day. I guess the background of having had not just a historical memory, but even a family memory of what happened during the Holocaust is a contributing factor perhaps to my interest in trying to look at this conflict through new eyes.
Well, it seems like you're picking certain things that are very, very valuable for the public to get a key insight into. You have some very key insights, and I think you write very masterfully, and they're even calling you a masterful storyteller. On some of the, other critics are even saying that about some of your books. And you've written also, what other books have you written that, haven't you written about coups, a history of the Americans' coup d'etats, CIA operations, things like that?
I've become a little bit of a specialist in that area. It's true. I sometimes think that maybe if this writing gig doesn't work out, I can always become a consultant in how to overthrow governments because I've studied so many of them.
You're an expert by then, by now.
It could be a growth industry these days.
You might advise the CIA make more money, right?
And everybody's doing it, so I'm getting to be sort of a freelance expert. There might be something out there. I've written two books about the first two times that the CIA ever overthrew a government. The first time was in Iran in 1953. That was the first government the CIA ever overthrew. And my book about that, All the Shah's Men, tries to reconstruct that coup almost on an hour-by-hour basis. Then I also wrote a book called Bitter Fruit about the second coup that we carried out. That was just 1 year later, 10 months later. We went to Guatemala to overthrow the president there, whose government had had the temerity to try to nationalize some of the land owned by United Fruit Company. And then more recently, I've written a book called Overthrow, which is a history of all the 14 times that the United States has overthrown foreign governments. So the full title is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. So that tells the whole story through Central America and the Philippines and all the other places that have had governments we've overthrown. And in each of those cases, I try to ask myself, first of all, what happened? How did we do it? Second of all, why? What led us to do it? And third, maybe most important, what has been the long-term effect of our intervention? And one of the patterns that emerges when you study all these interventions together is that many of them seem like great successes at first. We're so strong, we're able to overthrow almost any government and put in anyone we want. And if you look back a few weeks later or a few months or even a few years later, it seems like we had a great success, like in Iran when we got rid of the democratic leader, Mossadegh, who we didn't like, and then we put in the Shah, who would do everything we wanted. It seemed like a perfect outcome. Only years, sometimes even decades later, do we look back and say, that was a disaster, not just for the country that was the target, but for us. We undermine our own security over the long run by trying to fulfill our emotional needs of the moment. We want to have a victory, want to throw out someone we don't like. So we look for short-term advantage, and we're actually able to get it. But that short-term advantage sometimes turns into long-term real danger and damage to our own national security. So one of the lessons that comes out of the study of all these coups is that when you violently intervene in the politics of another country, you're doing something like releasing a wheel at the top of a hill. You let it go, but then you really have no control at all over how it bounces or where it's going to end up. And we should think longer term about our policies in the world. That is the exact view that led me to write this new book, Reset. If we were going to look over the long term toward the Middle East and think about what would be good for us and what would help stabilize the Middle East, what would be that policy? We need some new thinking. I think there's a wide consensus on that, because our policies to the Middle East have been manifest failures. But what would those policies be? That's the question that, using the stories of history, I'm trying to answer in this new book, Reset.
Oh, I have a question for you.
Go ahead, Charlie.
Did Venezuela come up as one of the overthrows? Or attempted overthrow?
No, and I'll tell you why. When I started writing my book, I went online and looked in some books to find the list of countries that the U.S. has overthrown. But then I found out there is no such list. And the reason there's no such list, as I slowly came to understand, is that it's very difficult to categorize. So it's almost a subjective thing. Did the U.S. overthrow this government or not? Sometimes the United States is involved in encouraging an overthrow. And in that case, I did not include it in my book. If the U.S. was only part of a coalition, I didn't include it.
We've got to cut away for a break. We'll be right back. Thank you, Steve.
Enjoy
your company tonight. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back to our special guest, Stephen Kinzer, and that's Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Kinzer, KINZER.com. Go there, check out his books, his bio, his audio videos, his interviews. Sir, I have a question. Was there any particular advisors that seemed to run a thread over the decades? One person I'm particularly interested to know about was is Henry Kissinger's involvement as an advisor.
It's very interesting you ask that question because as I've been a foreign correspondent all through the 1980s and the 1990s, and of course was following politics quite intently before then, Henry Kissinger was a figure who crossed my radar screen very often. It was inevitable, and I grew up during the Vietnam era, so I can remember that as well. When I went to write that book, Overthrow, and I got to the chapter about Chile, I thought to myself, finally, after all these years, I'm going to have the chance to get to write something about Kissinger. I describe in the chapter in that book, Overthrow, Kissinger's role in the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile. It's interesting that Kissinger himself really didn't have any interest in Latin America. He even once went so far as to describe Chile as a dagger pointed at the heart of Antarctica. In other words, a country that really didn't mean anything to the United States, which was true. But then he got motivated by some of his friends, including his political sponsor, David Rockefeller, the guy who first introduced him to Nixon and pushed him into this political world. David Rockefeller was a head of a large American bank that had huge investments in Chile. With Nixon then urging him on, Kissinger really took over the project in Chile and was the driving force that led to the overthrow of Allende. Now, he was definitely tasked to do this by Nixon. Nonetheless, his enthusiasm was most admirable. It was during this coup that was carried out an act that in my study of the entire history of American-sponsored coups in the whole world might have been either the low point or the high point, you know, the extreme of any single act that the U.S. ever committed. And here's what happened. The United States wanted to overthrow Allende and wanted to get the Chilean military to carry this out, but we couldn't do that because the commander of the Chilean military was a strict believer in the principle that the military has no business interfering in politics. No matter how bad the president is, it is none of the military's business. Because of that, the United States decided we wanted to assassinate this guy. And we sent two pistols and a silencer and ammunition in a diplomatic pouch to Chile to be delivered to plotters who the next day assassinated the commander of the Chilean military. Why was he assassinated? Because he defended a principle that is absolutely fundamental to democracy in America or any other country, and that is elected leaders have the power. Military officers do not intervene in politics. It was because this general, René Schneider, supported this fundamental principle that's basic to our own system, that we set out to assassinate him. Kissinger was overseeing this whole project, and it really reflects, I think, the one essence of Kissinger's career. I think he wants to be judged by his dealings with Russia and China and what he considers the important countries of the world, Europe. And I think it's his eternal frustration, and we'll go with him to his grave and beyond, that actually his reputation is going to wind up being shaped by his actions in countries that he never considered important, like Chile or like Indonesia or Cambodia, places that were to him very unimportant, but yet his actions in those countries resulted in huge suffering. So, I do trace him through this history, and he is a colorful and sinister figure.
And the powers that he represents. Yeah. One of the things that's always bothered me is that, you know, we say that we, okay, there's like the corporation of the United States, and then there's the puppet masters that control the corporation and the military powers of the United States. And there are people in advisory positions who are not elected, yet we, the people, end up, you know, as if, you know, we have done these things. I have done no such thing. And I, you know, I find these stories that you're telling abhorrent, horrible, and terrible, and they must be told. And I'm so grateful that you're doing it.
Well, let me just respond to you in one way, though. I understand what you're saying, but here's what I say. We overthrew the government of Chile. We are the ones sending, we are sending drones into Pakistan right now as we speak. So it's true. You didn't order it, and I didn't order it. But we're citizens in our country. It is being done in our name. And sometimes I think not to say we're doing it and just to say it's some clique in Washington or it's the arms industry or something is a way that allows us to remove ourselves from our responsibility. That's why when I talk about what the United States does in the world, I use that word "we" because I think we all have to understand that we are part of the entity that's carrying out all these acts.
Well, you know,
yeah, and
you
that's
know,
why America
Stephen,
hated so much.
Yeah, Kissinger has been awarded several bestowed several honors by the British, so the British are involved in this from the top on down because they were BP and Iran. And so forth.
Yes.
And so you've got to look back to the City of London and all that money power and that British power that they project through the use of us as surrogates. What do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the British relationship to Kissinger. There's another interesting fact that's not often reported about Kissinger, which is that there are many countries in the world, including in Europe in particular, where he loves to go, that he won't travel to. There are countries he doesn't want to go to because he's afraid that under some court system in some other country, he could be arrested and tried on charges stemming from his past behavior. So he's very reluctant to travel outside the United States and only does so after extensive research has assured him that he's not going to have any problems there. So at least it's in the back of his mind, even if he doesn't concede the justice of it, that some people feel his actions rise to the level at which criminal authorities would like to look at them.
You know, Stephen, and the leader now, the present leader in the Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey, there is a conflict over there. They're investigating what they have, a trial of the century, they're describing it at the Erdogan. Do you know much about that those series of trials that are unfolding? They link them to terrorist organizations, probably left behind groups like Gladio in Italy. What would your comments be on that?
This is a very involved case that reflects a very fascinating development in Turkey over these recent years. Turkey is the most democratic country in the Muslim world. And it also is a booming economy. Their economy this year is growing at a rate of second only to China in the world. In the last 10 years or so, Turkey's really taken some dramatic strides towards democracy. There always was a heavy military overlay to politics there, and it wasn't really possible for some groups in society to express themselves. A lot of that has changed now, and Turkey has begun investigating its own past. Because a government is now in power that is pressing for this kind of accounting. And what it's discovering in part is that elements in the military or security forces actually went rogue and tried provoking incidents like attacking villages and civilians to try to provoke conflict in Turkey.
Yeah.
The idea being that the military would then be able to say, oh, Turkey's in turmoil.
Right, right. We'll be right back. We've got to take another break. Thank you. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back to our guest, Stephen Kinzer. That's StephenKinzer.com. Welcome back, Mr. Kinzer.
Great to be with you again.
Yeah, Stephen, there was a report from Executive Intelligence Review, and this is what they said about the Ergonokin investigation of the century. Here's what comes right out of their publication. The planned Ergonokin strategy of tension complete with terrorist attacks and assassinations aims to pave the way for a military coup against the government of Prime Minister Erdogan. Like those of the P2 and Gladio in Italy, the Ergonokin investigation reveals links both to NATO and state security services and to terrorist assassination and criminal networks. What would be your comment?
It's true that many of these networks were a secret part of Turkish life for many years. In fact, Turks have a name for this network long before we came up with this word, Ergenekon, as you mentioned. They call it deep state. In other words, it's the state that's below or above elected officials and everything that you see in public. Now, why is it coming to light now? I think that's something that's interesting also because it has an implication for the United States. Turkey has become a much more democratic country in the last 10 years. That's what's allowed these investigations to begin and these plots, which have been going on for half a century, to be brought to light. Now, this new government in Turkey is not doing everything that the United States wants. Turkey is still an ally of the United States. We're NATO allies. Turks and Americans fought together in Korea, and we have been together all through the Cold War, and I think there's still a lot of solidarity between the two countries. But Turkey has made some of its own stands in foreign policy recently. In particular, of course, is that flotilla that they sent towards Gaza that resulted in the Israeli attack and the death of 9 Turkish citizens. Turkey has become very angry at Israel, naturally, as a result of this. The Americans have gotten irritated. But my idea is that Turkey has only increased its stature in the Islamic world. So at the same time that it is a NATO ally, pro-American, pro-European, it's also more sympathetic to other Muslim countries in the Middle East than we are. Now, that's irritated us, but actually we should step back and realize that in a way this is really good for us. Look, Turkey is a democratic country, and it's a capitalist country. Anything that we can do to promote the idea that other countries in the Middle East should be like Turkey is good for us. That's what we would like Iraq to become, and Egypt, and Syria, and Iran. So we should be promoting that idea. And the fact that Turkey is not always supporting the United States so reflexively anymore is actually good for us in the long run, because it shows those countries in the Middle East that Turkey is not just a lackey of the U.S., but at base, it promotes our values. Somehow we're not able to see this, and we're very angry at Turkey, and there's a lot of emotion running around in Washington, but really Turkey is a very intriguing partner for the United States in the future, and that's one of the main cases I try to make as I draw lessons from history in this new reset book.
Right. My reading of history says that the Young Turks were Masonic backed and based. And they secularized the government at the time. And it looked like to me that these secret organizations and these terrorist organizations have been controlled by those kinds of bodies and lodges within Turkey, but with several steps away of, layers of control. What would be your view or something like that, a statement like that?
Turkey's one of the places where the CIA stay-behind operation was most intense. We called it Gladio because of the name that came out of Italy, but in various countries, the CIA took as one of its first projects, when it was first founded, the establishment of these, what they call stay-behind networks, of people who would stay behind and fight the communists after the communists came in and took over France, or took over Italy, or took over Turkey. So where do you get this kind of a person who you're going to arm and you're going to train to be essentially a rebel, a guerrilla, a fighter? Well, you'd find them among ultra-nationalists, and you find them among gangsters. So that's what we did. We did it in Italy, we did it in France and some other countries, but in Turkey in particular, the entire ultra-nationalist right emerged
with deep connections to this CIA network, which the CIA was creating for one purpose, which was, in case there's a communist takeover, these guys will fight against the communist regime. But those people participating in it had a totally different idea. Their idea was, well, who knows if the communists are ever going to take over, but in the meantime, the CIA is training us in how to be great terrorists. We're super ultra-nationalists. If we see some leftists or some democratic movements we don't like, we're going to use our skills to go out and kill them. And the beauty of it is the Americans and our government will not come down on us because we're connected to them and they're sponsoring us. So it was this connection that has led to these decades of very mysterious and sinister assassinations and crimes that the present government of Turkey is finally beginning to uncover in this broad-ranging investigation.
Well, Ergun Ogun spent time in prison himself in 2006, I think, or something like that. They put him in prison for a while, did they not?
You're absolutely right. It was kind of a funny story. At this time, the guy, Erdogan, who is now the prime minister of Turkey, was the mayor of Istanbul, and essentially the military and military friends in the judiciary decided, we don't like this guy. Actually, they thought he was too Islamic, but really he was too defiant. He wasn't doing what the military wanted. So the word went out, find some charge so we can get him out of office. And they went through the record and they found out that he had recited a poem. And the
yes.
poem said, the mosques are our barracks and the minarets are our spears. The faithful is our army. They said, okay, you've just advocated the overthrow of the Turkish government by violent force of the Islamic Revolution. You're thrown out of office. And sure enough, they not only threw him out of office as the mayor of the biggest city in the country, Istanbul, but they put him in jail for about 6 months. Of course, he came out as such a big hero that he became elected the leader of the country. So it didn't work out really the way the military expected, and that's what's led to this conflict that you discuss now with these new revelations about what the military has been doing in the past.
Yeah, this so-called terrorist organization, there was a book written recently by two Turkish authors. And they went into detail about, they thought there was a lot of confusion about what Ergun Ogun was. And they went into detail, well, you know what, they're up on charges now. They're going to be tried in court in October in Turkey for publishing a book about this so-called terrorist Gladio-like organization.
Well, the reason that's happening is that the judiciary, the prosecutors in the country, are one of the last holdouts of the old sort of military-dominated regime that was in power for many years. Those prosecutors and those judges are very opposed to the more open democratic government that the people have elected. And so they're going after people who are essentially revealing the truth about what they've been doing. This is a further attempt to get at the government and try to weaken it because it is revealing these sins of the past. So all of this makes Turkey a fascinating country where democracy is finally shining light in some dark corners. And the fact that it's doing that should be an inspiration into other countries in the Middle East, and it should be something that would make the U.S. feel more positive and more eager to encourage the Turkish example throughout that region.
Right. Let me ask you this. There have been certain people after reading your book that said that because of the Israel lobby, that the possibilities of us reestablishing or resetting our relationship with Turkey and Iran would be nearly impossible. What would your opinion be?
I do think it's the right thing for the United States to remain a friend and supporter of Israel over the future, but I don't believe that Israel is going to be able to defend itself forever by military means alone. If you look at the geography of the Middle East and then consider the demography as it will unfold in the future, it's not realistic to think that just because Israel is going to be very well armed, it's going to survive forever.
Okay,
I'd like to see some move to try to calm the region, which I think is the only long-term guarantee for Israel's survival.
Stephen Kinzer, thank you very much for this interview. We've got to go off the air, but thank you very much, and you cast light where there is darkness. thank you very much this evening.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you, sir. Very much a pleasure.
Thank you, Charlotte. See you on the other side of the hour. Okay.
See you on the other side.
Okay.